Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Today we review 30 episodes, 31 to 60. The idea is 30 episodes in 60 minutes. We did this before with the previous 30 episodes and it was a really good show. It took a lot of effort to do the editing, but I think it was worth it and it's a great introduction for people new to the podcast. So here we go. Episode 31 was a review of all the previous episodes. Within 60 minutes, we did clips from many of the 30 episodes to give quick clips from those shows so people new to the podcast could get a taste of each show. As it was clips from so many episodes in episode 31, I'm not going to pick selective clips here. What I would just recommend is listening to episode 31 because it's fantastic content from our guests. Episode 32 was on reform, and I discussed whether interviews with experts in family law cases should be recorded and the pros and cons of that. Given a humble shoplifter is given the right to recording of their interview, why isn't a parent given the same right when the future of their children is at stake? Family court is part of the Ministry of Justice in the UK, as is CAFCAS. So why is a standard safeguard used in for nearly 40 years in this country absent in the family court? Episode 33 was another reform episode in which I discussed transcripts and bundles, the very serious problems there are with those in the court process and what can be done to improve them, and how this current state really does impact justice. Another example, a few months ago I was in a local court hearing with a circuit judge, and he said he was sure he would have said something in the last hearing. He was trying to recall something he had said, and he said, "I'm sure that what I would have said was..." But he was wrong. I remembered that he didn't say what he thought he'd said. He misremembered. There was no transcript to show one way or the other, and it's too cumbersome to get one after the fact, and it is often hard to be effective after the fact. There must be times when an important point is at stake, only for the process to flounder without a transcript to hand or a recording. A transcript and or recording should be automatic and free at the end of each hearing and available in the bundle for the next hearing. This would serve to make hearings more transparent, which is another bonus. The second thing I want to talk about today are court bundles. I'm astonished at the poor quality of court bundles. A few examples. I've delivered crystal clear PDFs to my child's solicitor, but when they put it into the court bundle, it looked like it had been printed out on a dot matrix printer, faxed a few times for good measure, then printed at an off-center angle. It was fuzzy and not very readable. It was poorly printed, and such was the effect that a judge may not have even read it. If I was cynical, I may think that was tampering with the evidence. If I was cynical, I may think that was the solicitor's aim. Why doesn't the Ministry of Justice build an app or a website for parties to share documents and agree a bundle orderly and in good time? There could be a section for documents to be uploaded that could be done in a linear fashion. You know, if you've got 6 months between a hearing, it can be done weeks or months ahead of the hearing, not at the last minute. Things can be agreed in good time, in a proper, orderly way. There's no excuse for the scramble that happens at the moment. An app or a website could also have a section for documents not agreed. It could also include video and audio links where needed. The system is broken, and it is a shadowy and dark system resisting the modern world. We need to shine a light on it and improve things. We need to begin changing family law at every level for the benefit of children and good parents, and also changing the law and systems around it so that many cases don't even need to reach court. Episode 34 came out around Christmas time, so we replayed the episode from Christmas 2022 because it had ideas. You know, Christmas can be a difficult time, and we had some ideas in that episode for how to cope. So there we are, 12 days of Christmas and 12 ways of coping. The commonalities are to change your state, break negative thoughts and patterns. These are key ideas taught in the personal development world, and they help with many of life's endeavours, positive and negative. There are many negative ways to change your state, such as drink, drugs, junk food, etc. But that just amplifies the damage and can lead to worse if you are being abused for a period of years. Stick to positive ways. The family court, abuse and alienation can bring months or years of undue stress. It's amazing that the system seems to allow this and does little to avoid it. This should never happen, but until things change, we need to cope. I've found nothing works all the time, but different things work at different times. In the moment, whatever works is worth its weight in gold. As John Lennon put it, whatever gets you through the night.
Episode 35 was one I'd wanted to do for a long time, on artificial intelligence and how it may fix family law. Things move very quickly. ChatGPT in 15 years will be, well, if it can pass a bar exam now, what will it be able to do in 5, 10, 15 years' time? Many people think we're only a few years away from what Ray Kurzweil calls the singularity, when true AI will occur, conscious perhaps. But even before then, the progress is going to be breathtaking. We're at the dawn of a new age. Resistant lawyers will be like cowboys in the Wild West, seeing the first cars roll into town. Change is coming. AI can level the playing field for those who can't afford lawyers. It can help courts by fact-checking and advising on case law and offering impartial and data-driven advice. It can test experts for competency and keep the system fair and up to date.
Episode 36 was around New Year, and seems a long time ago now. It was my thoughts looking ahead to 2024. It's fantastic to see Erin Pizzey and Jan James receive their MBEs. That does not happen automatically, so well done to all of those who nominated them. It's really inspiring to see Erin and Jan recognised. Next, I wanted to talk about elections. I heard somewhere a massive number of people live in countries with elections this year. I think it was 1 or 2 billion people. Obviously, America is one, and there will be lots of stories and fireworks there for sure. In each of the countries, voters can question politicians and ask what they are doing about family law. Even if the politicians are unaware of the problems, voters can bring pressure, raise recognition and awareness that may not be there now. It will help move the needle and bring change. We all have a part to play in that, and we can all do something.
Episode 37 was on incentives and how bad incentives can make bad systems. I looked at various industries, including family law, and I discussed how just changing the incentives within a system, for example, family law, would naturally bring about better outcomes. Talk to people who've been in the family court, or listen to the three people I've just mentioned in the Moonshots podcast. They talk about three gigantic industries: medicine, space and defence. Why would the same kind of incentives not play out just as badly elsewhere, such as in law? Human nature is the same whatever the industry. If you create incentives that do not reward people for being quick, amicable and low cost, you will likely get bad outcomes. Another way to put it is you don't need bad people to make systems bad. You just need bad incentives. Change the incentives and the behaviour of people in the system will change for the better automatically. Episode 38 was covering messaging and how we can use messaging with our children to touch the future, especially if we're not seeing our children, and how to do that in a constructive way. I want to revisit an idea we spoke about way back in episode 5, which was about parental separation in the movie Interstellar. It was a great episode thanks to Derek McDuff. I want to discuss one idea we mentioned. The reason was I was reminded of it after I recently saw someone post on Twitter about buying toys for a child they couldn't see. I guess it was a way of touching the future or connecting with their child and looking forward to a day when they would be able to give those presents to their child. This idea of touching the future is in Viktor Frankl's book Man's Search for Meaning, which I highly recommend reading. And it's also in the movie Interstellar in the way people message each other across space over the years. Episode 39 was about hardships, and it discussed how family court in some ways treats good parents and children worse than criminals. You can be falsely accused, treated as guilty without trial, and you may never even have a trial. You can have your children taken, you can spend your life savings trying to defend yourself and your children, and spend years of your life in trauma in the court system and still get nowhere. The effects of this can last the entirety of your children's childhoods, the best part of 20 years or longer if you and your children still have to deal with the effects. Let's contrast that with a serious criminal, for example, a terrorist or a murderer, who may only have one trial and possibly an appeal, which will cover a much shorter period of time, and they will be given free legal help. They face a simple test: did they commit the crime or not? In family court, the innocent can be found in a trial and still be treated worse than criminals. And the abusers can be found and nothing done. Many murderers will serve far less than the 20 years or more parents and children may suffer as a result of the family court. In Britain, the family court is run by the Ministry of Justice, but many good parents are treated worse than criminals. From the tactics I've seen used in a family court, I can see that every parent in the country is potentially at risk from what happened to me, yet they just don't know it, as awareness of what happens in family court is minimal. Only when a parent gets sucked into the system will the horror dawn on them, but by then it may be too late. You don't have to be a bad parent or do anything wrong to be treated worse than a criminal in Britain. Many criminals know they are guilty, so won't have the sense of grief, loss, injustice, or fear for their children that many parents do in the family court. In prison, you can even get your sentence halved for good behaviour, whereas in the family court, you can have time with your kids halved, even though you've done nothing wrong. I think many parents would rather go to jail for a few years than live with a couple of decades of abuse, injustice and alienation. Indeed, jail may seem like paradise by comparison. I don't know why the Ministry of Justice doesn't see that and correct it so families have a better time. All they have to do is compare the plight of criminals with that of good parents and children in the justice system. Episode 40 was a review of episodes 31 to 39. Episode 41 was looking at Britain's NHS banning blockers. This week, Britain banned the NHS, which is its National Public Health Service, from prescribing harmful puberty blockers to children. Basically, to just clarify, I'm not involved in the debate about blockers. And to me, it seemed, perhaps because I'm not involved in it, that the change came out of the blue. And also looking at the media, it seemed that some people were surprised, some commentators were surprised that this was announced. I don't know what led up to it, but I'll bet it didn't come out of the blue, and I'll bet a lot of hard work was involved. The people involved in both sides of that blocker ban would have had entrenched vested interests, just as we see in family law. That change happened in the face of entrenched vested interests gives us hope. One additional problem we face in changing family law is the amount of money they spent on lawyers, including legal aid lawyers, plus all the other experts that make their living in family law.
And I say experts, obviously they are of varying quality. Many of those experts and lawyers will resist change to family law. I spoke more about vested interests and incentives in episode 37. History is made up of tides. Maybe the tide is changing in ways that can help children, and hopefully it will happen with family law too. Episode 42 was looking at the protests that were happening at the time about the Garrick Club in London. Whether the club or any club should be allowed to restrict on gender is not the point of this episode. The point of the episode is focus, is the focus of the protesters. On the face of it, the argument for equality is a strong one. Although there are other single-sex clubs, as we've mentioned, and other exclusive places such as golf, country clubs, bars, other clubs and associations. Strikingly, the protesters about the Garrick Club seem to have a large proportion of lawyers and MPs. These people must regularly see horrendous and harmful inequality for their clients and constituents. Where are their protests for that? What they are focusing on says much. Now, maybe the protesters do support equality causes, and from time to time we see this in the media, so I'm not saying they are terrible and they don't support inequality causes, but what they're currently focusing on and whipping up a lot of publicity about is far down the list of issues important to the public. It would be good to see lawyers and MPs come together over equality issues and causes that affect normal people more often and with the same vigour. Most of the public cannot join the Garrick Club. With this issue, the protesters do not seem to seek inclusivity for all. They seem to seek to join an exclusive club themselves. It seems to be a case of it being about them, not us. They are focusing on a molehill in a valley surrounded by mountains that better deserve their attention if public interest is paramount. Once this storming of teacup is over, these lawyers and MPs with their out-of-proportion views will be in court and parliament making decisions in a more hidden way, and their out-of-proportion views may affect us, but we won't necessarily know so much about it. At least this week their silliness is visible and a light has been shone on it. And that is all I have to say, really. They are eminent people and their focus is misplaced. And they seem to lack self-awareness of this. What the protesters are focusing on says much when there is greater injustice all around for lawyers and MPs to do something about. In short, they should have better things to spend their time on that would help more people with bigger problems. And those people are the general public. And we need our lawyers and MPs to be doing better than this. Episode 43 was in our replay series in which I look back at favourite episodes. This one was my chat with Dr. Marnie Hill Fodorero, in which she discussed parental alienation, and it's one of my favourite ever episodes.
Very much so. Gaslighting and isolation, smearing. There's just so many strategies that these people use.
Yes.
And, you know, that's something that I never knew about. And I had to do a lot of research to look into what was this, what is domestic violence? What is narcissistic abuse? What is parental alienation? I didn't even know. But boy, when I started to learn and connect the dots, and then in addition, do my own intergenerational family trauma work, you know, look back on my own, you know, upbringing and what made me someone with weak boundaries or someone who was a people pleaser or who would ignore bad behavior for all these years. I had to look at myself and see my role in how this all played out, which is very different than the alienators. They don't look at themselves. They're always pointing the finger at others, blaming others, but they also do not look into themselves and want to change because they don't think anything is wrong with them, where it's the empathetic, loving loving parent that always is trying to look at what is in the best interest of the kids and you know, what is my role in all of this with the dynamics, you know. So it you know, the researchers, and there are top researchers in parental alienation, like Dr. Amy Baker, Dr. Jennifer Harmon, Dr. Craig Childress. There's a number of other people that, you know, speak on parental alienation. I, you know, just with my books, I'm contributing just a small part to the large amount of research and references and tools and, you know, resources for people to understand this kind of dynamic. And yes. Then if we continue to choose to live in light and love, you know, we're not fighting fire with fire.
No.
Because that's not how we're wired. We're loving good people. It doesn't even cross our minds to hurt other people. But that's not how everyone else is wired or how they operate. And so that's a rude awakening. And sometimes it takes these significant trauma situations like parental alienation or some of the losses that, you know, you've experienced when you leave a toxic, it's not even just a toxic individual, it's an abusive individual. We can have toxic people in our lives that are not abusive, but what we're talking about here is true abusive people.
Episode 44 was looking at the term expert, and is it overused? Should it be used in many cases, and how it is used in the world and in the court system? Today, I want to look at the word expert, not so much in terms of family court, but more widely in its use in society. My view is the word expert is overused and overvalued and should be seen for what it often is, an educated guess that is often without accountability. The harm that experts do runs throughout society on every level. There are few people in life who really know what they're doing well enough to be able to advise the way experts do. Another example is economics. The Federal Bank in the USA and the Bank of England in the UK, to name just two highly respected institutions, completely missed the boat on predicting a recent inflation surge. Transitory was a word used by those in charge, despite lay people and other experts saying otherwise. Still, the officials were the experts with the power. When they were proved to be behind the curve and wrong on inflation being transitory, it hurt millions of people who paid sharply increasing interest rates, with seemingly no consequence for the experts who got it wrong. Last year, I heard Peter Diamandis say on his Moonshots podcast that for every expert, there is an equal and opposite expert. It's a great quote, and it's a great podcast. I often recommend the Moonshots podcast. It's brilliant. Let's have a look at a tool that experts often use, and that is computer modeling. Many experts use this. It sounds high tech and hard for a layperson to challenge, except when you see the results. Recently, we saw health models fail on COVID response, economic models fail on inflation, and let's not start on weather modelling, which we see fail quite regularly. Across the media, sports, finance, technology, and education, and many other areas, experts fail all the time, but little is learned. As a society, we don't question experts anywhere near as much as we should. I mean, we see this on TV as well. Reporters and TV presenters seem to take expert advice too willingly and with not enough questioning, in my view. I think this sort of thing should be taught in schools to foster critical thinking, which is something children should be taught. As a society, we don't seem good at addressing how little we and our experts really know. In some ways, our society is built on structures of perceived expertise. I think we would benefit from being a bit more critical and a bit more humble about experts and acknowledge that often we and they just don't know the answers. Just to sum up, my view is the word expert is simply overvalued and overused and should be seen for what it is in most cases, a guess that is often without accountability. Experts are often giving us an educated guess and not much more in many cases. Episode 45 was looking at paternity tests, not just how they affect men, but how they affect women and children. And this was off the back of a recent story that had come to light where a judge had found out that his children weren't his, and this was many, many decades on from when they were born. Following a video clip of a judge that went viral recently, I want to talk about paternity testing today. An often quoted statistic is 10% of men are unknowingly bringing up children that aren't theirs. We don't know if that statistic is true, but it's often quoted. We have no way of knowing, really. To do that to another human seems like it should be a crime against the fooled parent and the child, for whom living a lie without knowing for decades that there was no biological link between them could cause indescribable harm. Yet it is common and there is no punishment. It seems like another gaping hole in the legal system. There's even a child welfare reason to do it. Knowing the dad's health history may help doctors anticipate issues the child may face and may help diagnosis. If the dad is unknown, the biological dad, if that they are unknown or if they're incorrectly identified, this could cause complications. I believe this whole area is swept under the carpet. It's not dealt with properly in the health arena or the legal system, and it can open up dad and children to immense harm. In other cases, children may never find out, and the father may never find out either. It's very hard for children to find out, for example, if the mum or the dad are no longer around. It may make that more difficult. These days, as I've said, children are allowed to find birth parents if they've been adopted. By contrast, children who are not adopted may not be able to find out if the person they call dad actually is. Episode 46 was looking at documentaries and the pros and cons of them and talking about mainstream media and new media. And this was after I received an approach from a documentary company. I was recently approached by somebody from a documentary maker about my story. I'm deciding whether to take part, but I'm often contacted by parents who want to get their stories out, and there's pros and cons to doing so, hence this episode. If any listeners want me to pass their details on to the person who contacted me, please DM or email me and I will. Episode 47 was in the replay series. It was with Derek McDuff, looking back at one of the episodes from 2022, in which we discussed parenting and child separation in the movie Inception. And we also talk about other movies too. It's one of my favourite episodes, which is true of all the ones we highlight in the replay series.
I think that's why Nolan kind of chooses that as a subject in this movie, and, you know, at least one other movie that we're going to talk about is that desire to get back to your children, because that is the most pure bond, like the love of a parent and a child. It's something that Spielberg touches on in Minority Report with Colin Farrell.
Yes.
He's talking to, he's talking to Tom Cruise, and he's like, parent losing a child is like the most, like blah, 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 whatever he says. So I think on that level, it is something that is really obviously going to hit someone with kids and with in a similar situation in so much more of a profound manner.
Another really good film with Spielberg's around that time is AI. And that's almost a reverse where it's the child wanting to get back to his mum. There's a really good scene. Again, I perhaps ought to do another episode. But there's a really good scene at the end where they bring his mother back, the aliens. But they can only do it for one day. And so he gets to spend one day with his mother. And it's really poignant, you know, the way it's done. But anyway,
I was just going to say real quick, you could do a whole thing about Spielberg, because Spielberg, you know, being a child of divorce, he, like, almost every one of his movies, at least most of them, are like have a bit of like divorce in them. Like Jurassic Park famously is like the grandkids are coming there after a divorce, and Alan Grant kind of is a disgruntled guy, doesn't want kids, and he learns how to become like a good father, and then that same arc repeats in like the next three Jurassic Park movies. And War of the Worlds is another one. Like there's a lot of that in Spielberg. I think he just kind of copes with a lot of his being a child of divorce in his movies over and over again.
You know, there's early on, Cobb calls his children. They're asking about him, when is he coming back? And we hear the grandmother in the background telling the children he's never coming back. And he then asks to speak to the grandmother and she hangs up on him. And there's that sense that the children are being cared for by an in-law who's hostile to the father. And he's finding it very difficult to even maintain a phone relationship with his children. Again, yeah, I think a lot of alienated parents can relate to that because it's not always just the parents that alienate. Often they're helped by their, you know, relatives and friends, and it can seem as if you're up against a whole wall of opposition. And I really got that when I saw Cobb trying to talk to his children. I don't know too much about Christopher Nolan. I think he does have children, but I don't know what ages they are, or I don't know if he has experience at a family court. But there seemed to be, in at least a couple of his films, this idea of a parent being separated from a child. And I mean, it happens so much in the real world. It may be that, you know, a friend or relative went through it and he saw him distress, or you know, who knows? But it does seem as something that he's very interested in, but I've never seen it written about.
Episode 48 was another in the replay series. It was with Derek McDuff. We did two back in 2022 with him, discussing two Christopher Nolan films. The first one was Inception, which we covered in episode 47. And this one, episode 48, discusses the movie Interstellar. And we also talk about lots of other things to do with TV and music and other films. Really good episode. Thanks to Derek McDuff.
It's a little bit like Inception in that it plays with time and space, but it's about a father trying to get back to his children. In this case, it's like Inception. He's got two children, but for some reason in Interstellar, he's much closer to the daughter than the son.
He really does not care about Tom at all. Like, it's like, I gotta get back to save Marf, my daughter. I'm like, I guess you don't care about Timothy Chalamet / Izzy Affleck, which, I mean...
Coop has to go, and Murphy's pretty distraught about this, and she says to him, you know, go, if you're leaving, just go. And he say, like, I don't want to leave like this, but he has to go, and she won't say goodbye, and it's really a touching scene. You know, he gets in his car and he's driving off, and you know, he's got tears in his eyes as he's doing that. At that stage, Murph changes her mind and rushes out to say goodbye to her dad, but he's gone.
You know, at the end, I'm kind of jumping ahead forward, but like Matt Damon, who is, you know, kind of despicable in this movie, but he is a really interesting quote-unquote villain because he is right about a lot of stuff. And he's like, yeah, the love that you have, like, it doesn't extend beyond the whole human race. Like, you will do anything for your kids, but you won't, like, make the sacrifice of, like, not seeing them again so that you can save all of humanity, or, like, make sure that humans survive with this plan B. And it's that kind of emotion versus logic thing that I think is really interesting that this movie plays with a lot, and the power of just, like, kind of love. And how one thing people ding this movie for is the way that they're kind of like, oh yeah, well, love is kind of the ultimate answer, and that's not really built up. But I think it is built up through the entire film, and that way love kind of transcends time and dimensions and gravity and everything else is such a cool thing. Yeah.
Episode 49 was me discussing the idea of accountability and whether there is any in family law. Most systems in the world, family law being an exception, measure outcomes and are improved over time using this feedback loop. The family court does not track outcomes, so nobody knows if decisions made are good or bad. The malicious and inept can make their way into the family law system, affecting hundreds of families for decades, with little or no scrutiny or tracking of outcomes. Family law is flaw after flaw. As parents, we're accountable to our children, and rightly so. But the courts, who may have given bad decisions affecting the children, aren't accountable. This includes the laughably termed guardians. What a joke. And I know many of you will share my view there. They need to get rid of that term right now. It's an insult. With some of the guardians I've met, it's like looking at a pothole and calling it the Grand Canyon. You might as well call them clowns. I'm not saying we do that. I'm not saying it fits. But it fits as much as calling them guardians in most cases. There will be exceptions, but in most cases. The family court needs to track outcomes and be accountable for them. That would be a strong force in changing the system for the better. All systems can be measured in some form. To not do this is reckless and detrimental to families. Episode 50 was a review of episodes 41 to 49. Episode 51 was me talking about authorities and how they fail us in life and court. I think on all sorts of levels, the authorities in Britain fail children in education, health, safety, family court, etc. It's just not a good country to parent in, and it doesn't support good parents and children. I think Britain has some of the best people in the world, but some of the worst institutions. The public there deserve better. It's hard to think of any government institution in Britain at the moment that is functioning well, and this has been true for many years. In this episode, I just want to cover a few current examples of how authorities in the UK and other countries fail public blatantly and without any excuse. I mentioned the cases and examples in this episode, not to be political, but to show that the family court system is just one system of ineptitude, vested interests, arrogance towards the public, and a wider lack of accountability that causes harm on all sorts of levels. Authorities hold us to a higher standard of behaviour and accountability than they hold themselves. That is wrong, it causes harm, and it must change. Episode 52 was part one of Dave Bond's astonishing family court journey.
She was making endless accusations, from claiming that I wanted to sell my child, saying that I wanted to kill her. Just a lot of outrageous accusations. No substance to it. And he had to be taken to a hospital and hooked up to an IV drip. Because he was so weak from malnourishment that he didn't have the strength to chew.
What they did find in January of 2022 is that the mother had actually paid $8,000 to a man to have me killed. And her friend was so freaked out that she contacted the authorities in the UK.
Yeah.
And West Midlands Police did investigate the mother, and stunningly, she actually asked the police for advice on how to kill me.
Wow.
So there was, so there was like, there was no confusion at all about what she did in fact do. There was clear evidence on, like, you know, accusations made against me.
Episode 53 was part two of Dave Bond's astonishing family court journey. Again, it just shows no awareness of what you've been through. You know, you didn't see your son from birth to 2 years. You've gone through a court case in a foreign land. You've had a hitman potentially come after you. You've just had years of stress and false allegations and worry about your child. And you've seen the flaws in the system. But no, they're the ones that are traumatized and have to leave the case. And you get misjudged without any real evidence. There's no evidence that you've been abusive at all. It's astonishing. And the mother
never had to participate in the proceedings because they ruled her to lack capacity. So she was just in. So she was just in and out of, being held for mental health issues.
Okay.
She was arrested a couple of additional times for trespassing and some other non-related stuff. So she's getting arrested, not charged, goes to a mental health facility. A couple months later, released, gets arrested again, mental health facility, no charges.
Wow.
So, I mean, it just should have been such a clear case, but instead, They ruled that he should go to the aunt. And the aunt, we were denied the right to cross-examine her.
Yeah.
I thought you're supposed to cross-examine both parties, but they subjected me to hours and hours of cross-examination.
Yeah.
Not the aunt.
Yeah.
And the foster care, who was so good with my son. That was the one silver lining in all this, is the foster care took really great care of my son.
Yeah, that's good.
Here's a segment from her judgment. Because in it, I should note, she mentions nothing about me posing any kind of a risk to my son.
Yeah.
There's no mention at all. It's only about there's toxicity between the parents. Well, no kidding. She hired someone to have me murdered. Yeah, there's toxicity. It makes no sense. And at face value, it makes no sense. Anyone that reads the judgment will be like, wait, but why?
Yeah.
Can't the kid be with the father? There's no explanation, not even something false. There's nothing. There's nothing there.
Yeah, I mean, what I find is there just doesn't have to be. They can present the evidence and positives as you know, you've just read out there, and then at the last minute they can sling in, but my judgment is. And not have to justify it. They can just do whatever they feel, I think. And whatever the merits are, they can just twist it at the last minute and say, yeah, but there's this phrase, best interest of the child, and that's a cover for anything they want to do. In my opinion, the best interest of the child is this, and my judgment is that. And it basically can sweep away everything, all the other evidence, all the positives. It sounds like that might be what happened there.
It's just incredible to know that one of my best defenses is actually in the judgment that ruled against me.
Yeah.
It's like, here, the judge said nothing but positive things about my ability to parent.
Yeah.
And yet said I shouldn't be in church. What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I know that this is very, very, very common in the UK, and it's a travesty.
Episode 54 was one of the replay series. I discussed adoption with Anna Maria DiDio.
My fundamental premise and the base, the crux of the adoption theory, if you will, is that all adoption begins with the trauma of separation and loss. So no matter at what age, and there's my daughter has an interesting situation that I can talk about in a second, but the separation from the biological mother creates a trauma that's known as primal wound. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with that, but it's something that I came upon, later in our process, and just reading and understanding it revealed so much to me in terms of the struggles my daughter was experiencing. So trauma, can manifest itself at any point within a child's life. And when we started to see those behaviors, we were wondering, what is this all about? Why is she acting like this? What's happening? We love her so much. And that's, kind of beside the point, is that the love of a family really doesn't take away the pain of the family that she lost, or we adopted her at age 7. So that was a very unique situation. She lost another family in Mexico, the family of caregivers. So there were so many losses that I did not take into consideration. And again, you stated it so perfectly. My mission is to really bring these things to the forefront so that families can discuss them and understand them.
Episode 55 was another in the replay series. I discussed with Orshi how we can use meditation and yoga to help cope.
So there are those, triggering buttons, and especially in the scenario that you are talking about, when you are going through that constant irritation, that constant recurring stress, that constant trauma, what we are talking about here, really, I think it's just really important to have like a toolkit for yourself. Whatever works for you is to just bring you back to who you are. And I know that within that trauma, it is really, at some point, it's just really difficult. I think there's an over-mystification about meditation and even yoga itself, because it doesn't have to be difficult. If you can sit on your bum, close your eyes, and just listen to your breath for 5 minutes straight and just try and guide your attention back to your breath. And it gets boring. Like, who wants to listen to their breath for 5 minutes? Nobody. So, I mean, I get that. But if you just give yourself those 5 minutes to just focus your awareness on that breath, that gives you a little bit of a break for the million thoughts that are bombarding you every like day in and day out.
Yeah.
It gives you that time and appreciation for yourself. Like, look, I am doing this for myself. I am giving myself these 5 minutes. This is just for me to just breathe, to just connect, to just clear my mind. And of course, the mind will not go empty. So there's no like, okay, blank.
Yeah.
So this is not the end result that we are aiming for, but we're aiming for you to just give you that time. And whenever you notice that, okay, I'm thinking about whatever, I'm thinking about what I'm going to eat, I'm thinking about the court case, I'm thinking about my kid, I'm thinking about like there's a movie playing behind my closed eyes already.
Yeah.
And just gently just telling yourself, okay, back to breath and just take a few more breaths. And again, if you just start with just a couple minutes, if it's just 3 minutes that you can sit still, then that's already more than nothing. If you can increase that to 5, hooray, celebrate yourself. If you can increase that to 10 minutes, great, wonderful.
Episode 56 was one of the replay series. I discussed the Family Court Reform Coalition with Mike Bell.
The whole report is online at your website for people to read, isn't it? And we'll give the link to that report in the show notes. But could you just give us an overview of the main proposals?
Yeah, there are 5 sections, one called Support for Families, second one called Reducing Incentives to Go to Court, third one Promoting Out-of-Court Settlement, the fourth one Improving the Court Process, and the fifth one is about evidence base, because one of the effects of having a secret family court is that nobody knows whether it's any good or not, because people don't do research. Journalists can't go to various courts and come out with an independent view, saying, I've been to 5 courts and this, I saw this each time. So obviously the thing that we'd really like is for people not to go to court. I think in the analysis, what we're clear about is it's the process which is the problem. Are there ways to reduce the incentives to go to court? I mean, I think it's these incentives which are the real evil in the system. Mm-hmm. That if one party can make an allegation of domestic abuse, they get legal aid.
Yes.
And it's not just that they get legal aid, it's that the process pays people to push people apart.
Yes.
While at the same time claiming that they're acting in the best interest of protecting the children. We're educating people on something that they didn't know about, in the same way that we've had to educate people on stuff that they didn't know about the environment. You know? And
yes. If we go back 30 years with the environment, it's perhaps similar, isn't it? It's raising awareness.
And it takes a long time. And what doesn't really work is demonizing people.
Yeah.
You just sit down quietly and say, look, there is a problem of acid rain. I mean, the problem was solved, you see, of acid rain. But at a certain point, most politicians were not aware what acid rain was. And the solution turns out to be relatively simple and actually not very costly.
Yes. Well, and the ozone layer as well.
Yes, exactly.
I think your report is a really positive step. So I would hope that people can go away and have a read of it and see if they want to get involved and engage with people who can bring about change.
Episode 57 was me discussing censorship after somebody tried to shut down my podcast. First, I want to set the scene. In the last few months, the world has watched as the UK has gone into meltdown in all sorts of ways. Who would have thought it could happen so quickly? I won't go into it too much here, but censorship is one of the ways. Censorship is on the rise there, with cancel culture and the jailing of people for social media posts. Simultaneously, the UK has been letting out violent criminals early to free up prison spaces. In my own case, on August the 15th this year, my abuser messaged me. Start off the quote. You need to delete your X account and your podcasts and website. Any books or documentaries you're in the process of writing or recording should be cancelled as well.
End of quote. They haven't said why. For a few reasons, I've felt in fear for my life over the last few months. I am really frightened about what's happening in my case, both in and out of court. I know so many go through the same as me and worse. None of us should, and we need to put energy into changing the system so that our children don't have to go through this when they become parents. I recently recorded an episode with a great guest. It was a great episode, thanks to them. All was well until the next day when the guest contacted me to say his employer had requested I do not publish the episode. Hello, censorship. By the way, it's nothing to do with my lousy presenting skill, and I could understand if that was the reason given, I could understand it. Anyway, we exchanged some messages with me asking what the objections were. Then suddenly his X account with over 5,000 followers disappeared. In the UK at the moment, you don't need to do anything wrong to be attacked. You won't be given, in all likelihood, protection from the authorities, and you may even be attacked further by the authorities. It's really scary. Episode 58 was one of the replay series I discussed with Jodie Gibson the subject of trauma and how to cope.
I share that in saying a lot of us have built our life in the fight or flight pattern. And we've normalized fight or flight. We've normalized dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
We've normalized trauma. And what we don't realize is when we normalize those things, it puts other things outside of reach for us. Like if I'm consistently in a fight or flight pattern, I'm consistently choosing things from a survival mode versus choosing them from a desired mode. So I'm not choosing things that light up my soul and set my heart on fire and feed me with happiness. I'm choosing things that keep me out of danger. I choose things based on what keeps me alive, even if I'm no longer in harm's way. Trauma, at least here in the US, is not taught.
Mm-hmm.
Like developmental trauma still does not exist in our DSM.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma is not something that social workers, psychologists, therapists, psychotherapists, no one's being trained in trauma. And so the effects of trauma are also not being addressed properly because people don't even understand what trauma is, let alone being trained in it. And so I think what the courts are doing and what the systems are doing and therapists are doing is trying to mask that dysfunction and or trying to address that symptom, never getting to the root cause. So they're trying to address the defiant kid. Or they're trying to address the kid who doesn't show up at school, right? The truancy.
Yeah.
They're trying to address the violent behavior or address the kids that are smoking or drinking or whatever they're doing without ever saying, wait a second, what's the root cause to all these things? Why are all these kids acting out and what's missing from them or what could further be developed in them that's not being addressed or acknowledged right now?
That's really fascinating what you said about the lack of knowledge that experts have in trauma. In my own case, the court, at the request of myself, appointed a psychologist to look at the case. And this was after they had found that I'd been abused for 3 years. And I thought that this would be helpful to go and see this psychologist. But they seem to have an astonishingly little grounded knowledge about the effects of the abuse, the effects the abuse might have had on me. They seem to have very little understanding that of the trauma that I had gone through. It's interesting to hear you say that that's actually probably quite common.
In the US, the biggest book that people are using, the biggest reference or resource tool people lean into is called the DSM.
Yes.
The Diagnostic Statistic Manual. So in that DSM, we're not even acknowledging developmental trauma. We're not acknowledging the root system to the majority of the things that are in the DSM.
Episode 59 was a wide-ranging discussion with Professor Ben Hine.
The way I would characterize it is that in the UK, I think we have a broadly unhealthy relationship with separation. And in places like Finland, they broadly, as a culture and a society, have a healthy relationship with separation. And what I mean by that is that they have, and this is underpinned by a lot of other concepts that they do, I think, in my opinion, much better in terms of gender equality and shared parental leave and all of this kind of thing,
yeah,
is that they generally have a more sophisticated and positive understanding of separation, in the sense that they acknowledge that it sometimes happens. They have a cultural awareness of that and that it can be done well. The other important thing to say is I think that it's also not seen principally as a legal issue in Finland. It's seen right. principally as a relational issue or a psychological issue or a mental health issue. So I think that helps as well, because people understand that when they separate, they are experiencing a stressor, a trauma. So it's much more psychologically informed. And therefore, the response to that is we should have a trauma-informed approach, which is that you probably need to go and speak to someone about it, have a mediator there, send to the voice of the children, etc. I think we predominantly see separation and the associated issues that arise from it as a legal issue in this country, which means that people will gravitate towards the legal solutions. And as you've already noted, those legal solutions do not actually help in many cases. And of course, there are cases that will always end up in court because they have to be there because of the level of risk or harm or complication.
Yeah.
But I would be willing to bet there is a vast majority that if they had had the opportunity to sit down with a mediator in a societal, with a societal backdrop that was an okay thing to do and that they should be doing that and it was the benefit of the children, etc., we had all that in place, we would probably see similar percentages like we do in Finland, which I think is sub 10% of couples that end up going to court, probably even lower than that, I think.
Wow.
So I think there's a lot, you know, there is a lot we can learn from other countries. And I always hold up Finland. Yeah, Finland's not perfect, no country is. But in my opinion, it's models like that that are at least doing a heck of a lot better job than we are currently doing, I think, to support separating couples. And I know there are dialogues going on about this. I do think it would be a positive introduction in this country to have a presumption of 50-50 shared care. Because at the moment in this country, we have a presumption of parental responsibility. So we make it clear to individuals that if they're a parent before their separation, they're still a parent after their separation, and that they have responsibility for a child. Now, the problem with that is that it doesn't give any framework for what that actually looks like.
Yeah.
And the brilliant thing about a presumption of 50-50 is that it does give some kind of framework to say that the baseline that you're starting from is that there should be a kind of roughly equal or equitable contribution to this child's life in terms of not just responsibility and decision-making, but contact and care. I think the most powerful tool in reframing our understanding of the issue and getting it embedded into the public consciousness that unless there is a reason otherwise, there should be a presumption that parents both have a robust kind of input into children's lives after separation. Whether that's exactly 50-50 or not is then up for parents to decide. But having a 50-50 presumption underpins the principle that is supported in the academic literature that a continuing relationship with both parents is a positive thing unless there is serious risk of harm to the child. That, for me, is the power of introducing the presumption. Sorry to jump in again, but I think that's the power it holds is to set that baseline presumption and to empower judges to go, actually, your case doesn't belong here. And also to empower solicitors to say, we shouldn't really be taking this to court, and to empower mediators to say, let's work with this presumption. You know, it should hopefully, and it's been shown to be the case in states where they have it. Any consultation, any change that you would make in this area, of course, will have an inevitable backlash against it from those with vested interests. It is up to those fighting for that cause to make a compelling enough argument to override that, is my kind of conclusion on that.
Episode 60 was a review of episodes 51 to 59. So there we are, 30 episodes in 60 minutes. Loads of great guests. Thanks very much for their great content. I hope you enjoyed listening. Take care. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.